I wanted to welcome everyone to today's internet seminar on the CARE National Program. Again, this seminar has been sponsored by EPA's CARE National Program as well, and it's going to cover the 2011 CARE National Webinar. My name is Jean Valens, and I'm here at EPA in the Superfund Program, where I'll be helping to serve as a moderator for the session. We will officially kick off the formal presentation in just a few seconds. We're going to give people a few extra minutes to hop on the lines and get themselves situated with their audio. And while we're waiting for them to get situated, I'll cover a few basic housekeeping items. Just a reminder, with all of the CLUIN seminars, each individual participant will be expected to move through the materials, the PowerPoint presentations that have been provided to you, at your own will by verbal cues from the instructors. So if you haven't done so already, when you registered, you would have been given an email confirmation message from me, which provided links to download the materials in a variety of formats, or a link to go to a seminar homepage and view the seminar materials online. So if you haven't done so already, you want to be sure to follow that link or download those slides and have them open or printed in front of you. Again, you can either look at them electronically through a web browser, you can look at them as PDFs, PowerPoint, whatever you prefer. And if you haven't found them, again, it's just at in the email confirmation message from me or at the CLUIN seminar homepage for the CARE session. Everybody should be looking at slide number one, which is our title slide, and I will ask those of you on the phone lines to please hit mute. If you don't have a mute button, please hit star six. Thank you very much. So again, I'm going to ask everybody, because this is a seminar where everyone has to manually move through their materials, to go ahead and click or turn the page to slide number two. If you're looking at the slides online, you'll notice a series of numbered links that appear on the left side. And you'll be able to click on those links to jump to the appropriate slide. Or you can also use the orange buttons that appear along the very top of your slides. There's a single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide, and a single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. So again, with the reminder, we do ask that everyone who's on the phone line, please place your phone on mute, hitting star six right now. We'll provide instructions on how to take yourself off of mute at the appropriate time when we do question and answer with our instructors today. If you have another call that comes in, we do ask, do not place the call on hold. Sometimes there could be background music, which can be disruptive. So if you have to hang up, that's fine. You can certainly dial back into the call afterwards. So again, just keep us on mute. Don't put us on hold. For this particular session, we will go through a number of materials that are organized in a PowerPoint presentation, and there are a number of references and resources that the instructors will refer to that you'll be able to access after they go through the materials today. We will have ample time for Q&A with our presenters today, and they are advising that the questions will be addressed at the end of the formal presentation. So they're going to go through the PowerPoint materials, and at that point in time, we'll then provide instructions on how you can take yourself off of mute and ask a question by phone. Or for those of you who are streaming the audio, you'll be able to type up and submit an electronic comment or question that I will read on your behalf to the instructors. In order to submit an electronic comment or question, you can simply click on the question mark button that appears at the top of your slides. You want to be sure your pop-up blockers have been disabled, because when you click that question mark button, a new window will open up where you can type up your message or comment. And again, I'll read that on your behalf at the appropriate time. So you don't have to wait until the end to submit electronic questions. You can certainly type those up now, but again, we won't get to those until the end of the formal presentation. A reminder that this entire session is being recorded. So if you find that this is helpful or you'd like to refer a colleague or coworker to this session, automatically when today's session is available for free download and replay, you'll get an email from me letting you know where it is and how you can access it. So you can certainly forward that on to anyone that is interested. There will also be two additional deliveries of this very same webinar later on in the year, and we'll provide information on those at the conclusion of today's session. Again, everyone has to manually move through the materials at verbal cues from the instructors. If you have technical problems, you can certainly use the very same question mark button to report a technical glitch or ask for assistance. Just be sure to give us a telephone number where we can reach you. And I think those are the end of the reminders that I have before we officially kick things off. So what I'm going to do is ask everyone to move on to slide number three, which is the official start of the CARE presentation materials for today's event. And with that, I'll turn things over to Marva King for an introduction.
Great. Thank you so much, Jane. Thank you so much for getting us started. And I want to apologize to all of you out there that we had technical difficulties this afternoon. And if you understand about technical difficulties, if you have any, make sure you let us know. Again, I want to thank my co-presenters on this call who are here with me in the room, Catrice Jefferson and Dennis O'Connor. I know Michelle Mendolia is on the phone, and if any of my other co-presenters are on the phone, could they let us know now?
Keisha Holliday.
Great. Okay, so what I want to do is go through a very quick slide presentation about the CARE program, and this is, will give you an overall sense of what the CARE program is. This webinar, this first in a series of three, is to let you know a little bit about the CARE program, a little bit about the RFP that's on the street, but it's right now. But it's basically for you to ask us questions that we can answer for you. This is a national webcast. This is the only way we can do this when our RFP is already published. So if you will go to the slide presentation, and we're going to go to the next slide. Right now you're looking at a slide that says Request for Proposals Q&A webcast, February-March 2011. So I need you to turn to the next slide that says What is CARE? And again, I'll do this as quickly as possible so we can get to your questions. And as a reminder, we will go through the questions at the end. We'll take one from the phone and read one from the email. So we'll do it back and forth that way. When you're asked the question on the phone, you need to know who you are and where you're from. We'll already type that on the email, hopefully. Okay, the slide is called What is CARE? And for those who you that do not know, and thank you, we have 156 participants today, and we're really proud to have you on the call. So make sure you put your phone on mute because I hear some conversation in the back. Thanks.
Exactly. It's either your own mute button or #6. Thank you.
So what is CARE? CARE is a community-based, community-driven program created to build partnerships to help communities understand and reduce toxic risk from all sources. What does that mean? What does that mean, right? It means that this is a program, one of a very few in the federal government, where you decide what you're going to do with the grant money. You as a community partnership decides that based on our parameters. So we don't want one particular applicant leading this. We want the partnership leading this. And you have to include all your partners in the discussion. Next slide, please. It goes, why CARE? Like, why was CARE formed? It was in response to community requests for help. We heard a lot of information, a lot of concerns. Again, I don't know who you are, but you need to mute your phone. We have too many people on the line.
Catrice, I'm going to recommend that you globally mute everyone. So for the instructors on the line and everyone else, you're going to hear a message that's going to come on the line. Catrice, if you hit #5 when I'm done making this reminder, it'll let us know that it's globally been muted, and then I'd ask the instructors to then hit *6 so you can continue speaking past the global mute.
Okay.
Catrice needs to hit *5.
Nobody else has to do anything. Please, everyone hang tight on the line. Catrice will hit a command, which is #5. And then the instructors who need to present may hit *6 to continue talking through the mute. Everyone else online can simply hang tight.
Jean, is it *5 or #5?
It's *5 to globally mute, and then it'll be *5 to globally mute, #5.
The leader has muted your line.
And then she said #5. Can you hear us, Jean?
Yes, we can. We can hear you.
Yes, okay. So I'm on the Why CARE slide, and why do we need a CARE program? It was to develop a means to address concerns that are beyond the reach of national regulation. It's to integrate agency programs to improve support for communities, and it's to mobilize new resources and use local knowledge to achieve results. And it's also to develop community consensus on sources of risk and risk reduction options. What does all this mean? All this means is that we want to make sure that you are able to figure out for yourself with your partners and your technical experts how to improve your own communities that no one else has to study you and come in there who's not a part of your community. You can do it yourself. And that's what we heard, and all the concerns that were raised, that they were tired of people coming in and studying them. They wanted to do this themselves, and we said, yes, you can, as long as you form a partnership and use the parameters we have in the RFP. Next slide. Funding for care communities. It's a nationally competed cooperative agreement, and it's going to be awarded in two categories. The level one average is about $90,000. You can get up to $100,000. Level two average is about $275,000, but you can get up to $300,000. And it's nationally competed, and it's a cooperative agreement. And a cooperative agreement means that it's a little bit different from a regular grant. It's a type of grant, but it means you have extensive technical assistance, and EPA can work very closely with you to help you along the way. Next slide. Care goals. These are goals that are in your RFP, and it's the goals that are stated here. I'm not going to read them. You can read them for yourself, but I think they're pretty good goals because we want to help you reduce your exposure to pollutants. We want to help you gain an understanding of different sources of exposures. We want to help you work with communities to set priorities, and we want to make sure you're creating self-sustaining community-based partnerships. Next slide, please. These are our strategies. Again, they're in the RFP. This should not be new to you if you've read your RFP. If you have not read it yet, please look it up. It's right there for you. These are the strategies we adhere to in the CARE program, and we want you to adhere to as well. When you articulate what you're doing to us, you have to do it in a way that shows us that you're meeting these strategies. So you have to build an effective collaborative partnership. And at the very minimum, that partnership has to include community organizations and residents, businesses, and governments. Level one does not have to include the business yet. Level two, it's imperative that they do. Level one can tell us their plan for including the business. Provide information, tools, and technical assistance. We want to see how you're going to help your communities understand all their sources. Build consensus to prioritize, to work on your priorities for effective action. Okay, so you have to articulate how you're going to build consensus across your community, how you're going to prioritize your risks. This is all part of the RFP, and I'm just making it a little clearer for you. Next slide. Focus on action. How you're going to do this kind of stuff, you know, is important. I think you need to think about it in a level one, but you really got to do it in a level two. So you have to show us how you're going to do it. Facilitate networking among care communities. We believe that we try to do this at all times. This is not something you have to show us how to do. We're going to help you do this. Build long-term community capacity. You always have to be thinking about this. How are you going to build that long-term community capacity? We're going to help you the best we can in our different training workshops, but it's something that you need to be thinking about from the very beginning. Next slide. This is a schematic that shows you how CARE works. CARE works in these four steps, and these steps are real easy, and they're broken down as a level one or a level two. And they're not something that you have to do in order, but you have to look at the total picture. So for a level one, you come together, you join together. That's your building your partnership. You know, that partnership that has to include residents, business, local government. Okay. For a level two is when you articulate how you're going to identify the problems across your place-based area. How are you going to do that? You have to articulate a process for that. We don't tell you how to do that. We give suggestions on the CARE website. There's one that's called the CARE Roadmap that you can look at. There's another that's called PACH, which is the Protocol for Assessing Environmental Health, and it's put out by HHS's CDC, Centers for Disease Control. So those are just examples. You can call it the Marva King process for all we care, as long as you articulate a clear process on how you're going to come together, build a partnership, identify your problems, figure out some type of way you're going to address it to have solutions, and how you're going to make priorities to make sure that you start addressing these in a priority order. All this is important But it's most important that community residents are involved, businesses are involved, and local government. That's a level one. Level two, implement solutions, reduce risk. That means you've done all the work as a level one, and you're going to tell us how you're going to articulate to us how you're going to start making sure your community is very healthy. So by doing that, you're going to tell us how you're going to start reducing some of your environmental pollutants. That's why the level two is a little bit more money, but we ask for a little bit more information, and you have to really articulate that to us, because level twos are extremely competitive. Become self-sustaining. This is a requirement of a level two. We don't want you to leave the level two without being self-sustaining. So you have to start thinking about how you're going to carry on with the work. We ask all of our level ones and level twos to think about that, but it's mandatory as a level two for you to think about that. Next slide. Now, this is very important, and it's hurtful to a lot of people because we have not done this before, but you know what the situation is in the country. You know what the budget situation is right now, and because of that, we don't have a budget fund at EPA, and because of that, this year, we could only award Care Level 2 cooperative agreements to applicants that have already received a Care Level 1 cooperative agreement. Why is that? Why could we only award to Care Level 2s that have already gotten a Care Level 1 when in the past we awarded to Care Level 2s? It's because for the past 5 years we've been a demonstration program, and this year, 2011, we have to become an implementation program. That means that we're not demonstrating anymore, which we're implementing our program. And it also means that we have to make sure that we continue on as a program and have more funding from Congress, et cetera. And so what that means is that we cannot, we have the language in the budget right now, but the budget hasn't been signed, and because it hasn't been signed, we can't move to that next level. So this year, we hope it's only this year. We don't know what's going to happen next year with the budget. But for this year, right now, we cannot award to any level twos unless they've already received a level one. This is a legal requirement that came down to us. It broke our heart to do it, but there was nothing we can do. We have to follow the rules. Next slide. We wanted to show you how care creates change in EPA, and it does it in a lot of ways. We have a strong headquarters presence, but we also have a regional partnership that we love and we work with and we work very hard with. What happens in the regions is that every time a care grant is awarded, a regional team is formed around them. So headquarters, like me and Dennis and Catrice, we work with that regional team, and that regional team is set up. If you're a CARE grant awardee, that regional team is set up to personally help you every step of the way. What CARE does by creating change in EPA is that we work across the agency. You know, if you know anything about EPA, you know there's air office, there's a water office, there's a waste office, there's a pesticides office. Well, we know that communities think of us as one government, one EPA. So we, with CARE, have decided that we are going to operate as a matrix. Various people on the CARE teams are from different of those programs, from waste. I'm from the air office. There's Michelle Mandolia is from another office. So we all try to work together across the agency to work with you. And we're looking at ways to see how we can look at this from a cumulative risk approach, because we know you're looking at it from a cumulative risk approach. So we're pretty forward-thinking with the CARE program, and so because we're on the cusp of everything, sometimes we get tied up with budget concerns, and it makes us not be able to do exactly what we want in a timely manner. Next slide. This is the funding we've had so far on this. We, as you can see, at one point we had quite a lot of money. Certainly our money has slowed up, but we're still awarding grants. We're still giving them out to communities. We've still been fortunate to get some assistance from different program offices to help us award 2 additional grants last year that wasn't part of the CARE money. Our budget is tight. It's the same way this year as it was in fiscal year 10. Because we don't have a budget, we have to adhere to the fiscal year 10 budget. So again this year, and fiscal year 11, we're going to be awarded we will be awarding $2.1 million. Next slide. So we always say that CARE is more than money, and what does that mean? It means that regional team that I told you about is the one that we try to give you direct technical support and scientific expertise with. We also try to give you networking opportunities. We also try to help you with planning how to identify and reduce your risk. We have a national workshop every year, but we also do things throughout the year, like have webinars to help people with specific concerns that they have. So we try, once you're in the CARE family, we try to make sure that you have all that you need in the way of technical support that you may not would get from other programs. Next slide. These are some tools that we have up on our website for you, the www.epa.gov/care website. These are tools that are available to you. There's a lot more, but I just want to point out the one that's called the roadmap, and that helps you articulate a process on how you may want to do a CARE level 1. You don't have to use it. You may use it as a guide to look at it. It's very logical, very simple. I'm sure when you read it, you say, oh, I get that. I know how to do that. So, it's just there as a document for you to look at. We also have a document, Community Guide to EPA's Programs, that let you see all these different programs that we have available that can help with you. The CARE Resource Guide is another one. It's a drop-down online guide that if you type in a keyword like asthma, you can find some resources for asthma. The Grants Guide is something we did in collaboration with two of our federal partners. And we wanted to try to make sure that we had a guide that told you about different types of resources out here, federal resources, because it's part of you being sustainable, how you can become more sustainable. Next slide. And this one just shows you where we are right now. We're all over the country. You can see for yourself with this map. There's places that we have gaps that we're not there. It's just that we haven't gotten very good applications from those states yet. So we're all over the country. We're a small program, but you can see we're widespread. Next slide. So these are just some contacts. I am actually the CARE co-chair for the first time this year. I'm still the CARE grants team lead, so I'm still part of that, but I'm also the CARE co-chair. Gail Bonanno is also the other CARE co-chair. She's actually from the Office of Water. And it tells you our website and our hotline. And so this is the presentation. We're done with the presentation now, and we're going to open it up for questions because we want this webcast, as I said, to be about you and your questions to us. And that's why we have all the experts on the line with to answer your questions. So we'll start questions now, Jane.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. So this is a reminder. We've turned on a global mute, which means it overrode any local mutes you may have used on your phone so that only the people who have chosen to unmute could talk through that mute. So I'm going to remind all of the presenters who will be here to answer questions right now, you need to hit #6 to take yourself off of mute, and that's only for the presenters for right now. So again, #6 for presenters. Take yourself off of mute to answer questions. For those of you who are participants and would like to ask questions out loud, the reminder for those of you who are streaming the audio online, we are sitting at slide number 17. Again, we're going to open it up for questions. For streaming audio participants, to type up a question electronically, you'll click on the question mark icon that's located at the top of your slides. A new window will open up. You want to be sure that your pop-up blockers aren't disabling that. You want to be sure that it's not hidden behind your browser window. And type up your comment or question. I will read that out loud on your behalf. Those of you on the phone lines, in just a second, I'll turn over to you and allow you guys to ask questions directly to our presenters on the phone lines. But I'm going to start with 2 comments and questions that have come in online, and then we'll switch over to some telephone questions for a minute. So the first question that's coming in online comes in. They're making a question from Kansas State Pollution Prevention Institution in Manhattan, Kansas. And they ask, the clarification on a point that you made earlier, and I'm going to read the entire statement. Please clarify the note in this year's RFP, and in quotations, they have note, due to appropriation law concerns, until Congress provides separate authorization, EPA can only award Care Level 2 cooperative agreements to recipients that have already received Care Level 1 cooperative agreements. And that's the end of the quote. And her question is, does this mean that the entity that was awarded the Care Level 1 needs to submit the Care Level 2 proposal? Or can another entity in the same Level 1 community submit the Level 2 proposal?
What it means is that that partnership that was done for that community needs to, if they've done a Care Level 1, they need to submit a Care Level 2. Now, I don't, sometimes we have a partner of that partnership that submits it. And that's okay as long as they articulate that, that and show that they were one of the partners in the Level 1. Does that make sense? Barbara?
Yep, and Barbara, if it doesn't, feel free to go ahead and type up another clarifying question or comment to that one. Again, if you're online, continue those comments and questions coming in. I know that there's additional ones. I'm going to take the next one, and then we'll switch over and try to get some phone questions.
Jane, we're not taking questions from EPA. They can email me directly.
No questions from EPA. Not a problem. Okay, then I'm going to take one more question online. We'll switch to some phones, and then we'll come back to the online participants. So this next question that's coming in from an online participant is coming from the Orange County Department of Health in Newburgh, New York, and they ask, are you awarding Level 1 cooperative agreements this year?
Most definitely we are. We always award Level 1.
That's why we're doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not, I mean, we look at who's the best competitive, you know, proposal. And so if that particular Level 1 is the best in that region, then we award it. Yeah, most definitely.
Okay, great. Thank you. So let's try to take a few questions or comments from our phone participants. So reminder, we did globally mute all of you. So if you do have a question for any of our presenters today, you'll first need to hit #6, and then we ask that you identify yourself and your organization, and you'll be able to ask your question directly. So if you have a question or comment, go ahead and #6, and then let us know who you are.
This is the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona, and we have a question related to some of the optional attachments. On page 26, letter C, there's a notation of a quality assurance narrative statement, and we'd like to know if you can provide more information on what that statement should entail and what is needed in that attachment.
You're talking about page 26 of the RFP?
Yes.
We can supply that. I think that we would work with someone like Keisha Holloway of the grants office to get that to you.
Let's commit to this. You're now updating the question and answer document that if it's not on the web, it will be there ever so shortly. We add to that along the way. Let's commit that we will add the answer to this question, the question and answer.
And we'll put a link there for you on the, Q&A document. And just so for everyone to know, we have a question and answer document that's placed on the website along with the RFP. And so it also should be up, if not today, then I don't know if Jean has had a chance to put it up yet.
We got it up there, and at the end of the session, you guys will be directed to a page of resources, and that will be one of the documents you'll be able to download right after today's seminar.
So it will be up there, and we'll put a link there for that quality assurance statement for you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, great. And the next, we'll take another question from our phone line participants. Remember, hit #6, and please identify yourself.
This is Donna Wojciechowski from the Massachusetts Opportunity Council.
Okay.
My question is that I'm looking at the CARE Committee Environmental Health Issues list that you compiled in 06, and as some of those issues, I'm looking at walkability, I'm looking at the lack of outdoor recreational opportunities, property maintenance, vacant lots, and our community is concerned with those issues, And I would like to know how we can connect them more closely with environmental toxins. For example, connecting low-income communities with outdoor recreational opportunities, I think, is an important thing that we would like to do in our community. And can we put that in with looking at the goals that the EPA has for their strategic plan?
So let me tell you, just so you're clear, I'm assuming you're talking about a CARE Level 1.
Yes.
And, okay. And so for CARE Level 1, the process is that you identify all your concerns across your place-based area. So those concerns include the ones you just said. So CARE Level 1 is that identification process. Those concerns that you identify do not have to be, at this point, environmentally linked. They have to be concerns that your partnership, your residents, your businesses, your local government have identified as a concern, a problem for the community. That's all you have to do for CARE Level 1. And then you have to go into a consensus-driven process and prioritization process. And if those concerns rise to the top of the list as a priority, then we need to talk about how you articulate them to get some reduction of risk in a level two.
Okay,
and some of those ones that are not EPA specific, the risk has to be reduced with a partner from another federal agency or, you know, some type of other type of partnership.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, and we'll take another telephone question. Again, if you're on the phone lines, you want to be sure to hit #6 and please identify yourself before asking your question.
This is Erin Heaney from the Clean Air Coalition of Western New York. I'm looking at page 24 of the RFP, and it says Level 1 project description should include a reasonable level of detail on the following. I'm wondering what a reasonable level of detail means. Is that just that the five bullet points there should really take up the bulk of the project description?
Well, I'm just seeking
clarity on that. Yeah.
When you're doing this, you got to remember and look back at the evaluation criteria to make sure, because there's points attributed to the evaluation criteria, correct? And so you got to make sure that you get all the points that you need from the evaluation criteria. And and also at the same time, you have to make sure that there's a question at the very beginning of the RFP that talks about what does it mean? I'm going to find it in a minute as I'm talking to you. What does it mean to identify the meaning of communities gaining an understanding of all the potential sources of exposure to pollutants and environmental concerns. So my advice is for you to read it's number 5 on page 6 of the RFP. My advice is you to read that and then also look at your evaluation criteria, because we're not asking you to be a scientist right now, because we know this is a community partnership. But we're asking you to address these elements in a way that articulates to us. You got a group of team who's reading these proposals that articulates to us that you understand what we want, and that it's clear to us that you have a process in place or goal in place to get to what you need to do for your community. So I can't really tell you specifically what to write, but I would suggest you read number 5, and then look at the evaluation criteria, and look at the points that we're asking for under those evaluation criteria.
Great, thank you.
Okay, we've got a bunch of questions that have come in online, but I'm going to squeeze in a phone line question first, and then we'll switch over to read some of those online questions. So again, if you're on the phone lines, feel free to take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, identify yourself, and then ask your question.
Hi, this is Allison McCann at the University of Rhode Island, and I have a question about the CARE Level 1 grants, and if a project can actually focus in on a particular concern in a community, say for instance drinking water, and looking at all the issues perhaps that are identifying all the issues that are affecting, say, a drinking water concern in a very, in a particular community, or maybe it's air quality. So can it target on a specific media, if you will?
No.
Okay.
The CARE RC clearly states that we're a multimedia program. It clearly states that you have to look at everything across your place-based area in a level one. You have to not only look at water, you have to look at air, you have to look at waste. You know, you have to look at all these things. Because we feel that you won't have a sense of what the problem is until you look at everything. If you want to look at just drinking water, you need to go to a drinking water type grant.
Yeah, that's fundamentally what makes this different than a host of other EPA grants. This whole idea that you're looking across the vast array of pollutants, toxics in your community, and really assessing those through the process, and then we either get to a level two, perhaps plans to address them.
And just to follow up with what Dennis is saying is that sometimes communities know, they just know that's their problem. And we understand that, but we want to see that you're looking at everything. We want you have to prove to us that you looked at everything. Now, what may happen in your prioritization of the CARE Level 1, drinking water may come to the top. And if that happens, that's fine. You address that in the Level 2.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we're going to switch over and start reading through some of the questions that have been submitted electronically online. We will go back to the phone lines. We're going to kind of keep going back and forth. So if you're on the phone lines, just hang tight for a few minutes, and I'll provide a reminder when we go back to the phones on how to ask those questions. So I'm going to start with a question that came in online from the Taunton River Watershed Alliance in Taunton, Massachusetts. And this, I think, is related to a comment that you just made. They ask, or they make the statement, I know that this is multimodal, but can there be a focus on water?
So I just answered that question with the other lady. No, not for a level one. You have to look at all the different media across the board for that place-based area.
Okay, thanks. The next question comes in from an architect firm in St. Louis, and they ask, would community greenhouse gas emissions planning be eligible for CARE Level 1 and or Level 2 funding?
So you have to be clear. Maybe I need to be clearer. But for CARE Level 1, it's multimedia. So greenhouse gas emissions planning may be a part of that multimedia issue. But, you know, you have to, for CARE Level 1, you have to articulate your plan of looking across your area for everything. So you have a whole list of issues you're looking at. Greenhouse gas could be one of them, but it can't be the primary one. And for level two, again, as we said, when you prioritize your risks and you do this by consensus with your partnership, then the greenhouse gases has to come to the top to be one of the top priorities for it to be in a level two.
And you have to have a plan that's actionable. Just talking about transboundary issues, is not going to be successful. You have to have a plan that you can put in place to address these problems and measure the results.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to go to the next question that comes in online. And they're coming in from, I'm going to mispronounce this, it's in Massachusetts, but the organization is BCBOHA in Egremont, and I apologize if I mispronounced your location in Massachusetts. But they ask, how competitive would a CARE grant application be that was designed primarily to support an EPA project that is currently cleaning or removing PCBs from a local river?
I would answer it as we have already, that CARE is a multimedia program. So we look at a variety of different issues and concerns. We cannot target something like removing PCBs from a local river. It could be one of the issues they're looking at. It cannot be targeted as an issue.
A more global response is perhaps a lot of you have projects that in your heart you know are valuable, and you're looking around to come to CARE to pay for this, to bring it to fruition. That's not how CARE works. CARE works a bit differently, as Marv has mentioned, and it's really a bottom-up approach and starts with looking at everything. So you have to walk into the CARE process with really an open mind and a willingness to look across the broad array of possible toxics that you have in your community.
And some people are just not there with us, with this. And we say to them, you know, thank you. Maybe care is not for you. But we have quite a number of people who do want to apply for a CARE grant. We had 189 applications last year. So there's a number of people who are looking at it this way. And, you know, we're not the answer to everyone.
Okay, great. I'm going to take another question online, and then we'll switch over to get some more phone comments. The next question comes in from the city of Kent in Washington State, and they ask, when you talk about the partnerships that are part of the grant requirements, are you saying there needs to be more than one group, organization, or agency behind each proposal?
No, we're saying that you have to form a partnership. There's one eligible applicant, and it's in the RFP who are the eligible applicants. But that applicant has to form a partnership that's broad-based, and that partnership has to drive the project.
Okay, thank you. So let's go back to the phone lines. Again, a reminder, if you're on the phone and you have a question or comment, you'll want to hit #6, state your name and organization, and then go ahead and ask your question.
I'm Deborah Weiss from the Commission for Green Tomorrow. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay. The question I have is, you're saying that it has to be, you know, multimedia, that we have to address water, waste, air. Can you use the funding to possibly get something like an air monitor when you know that a lot of the issues with both water and air are coming from a lack of monitoring? Is that an acceptable request for this grant?
Yeah, well, what we try to do, I mean, first of all, as the eligible applicant, you articulate what you want to do for the project. If you get awarded, we try to work with you to do things that you want to do. But what we try to do for something like that is that we have a lot of partnerships with the agency, and there's different program offices who may be doing some type of air monitoring for air or water. And we try to connect you with those programs so you wouldn't use your CARE money for that.
Well, that's why I'm asking, because actually in the state of Wisconsin, the DNR here doesn't have anything for our area, and we've already been talking with them.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I'm asking that direct question, because it's kind of a weird situation where there should be ones and there aren't.
Yeah,
and
but just so you know, we're going to look at your total package. If your total package is heavy on air monitoring, I'm just being honest, it probably won't get through.
This is Margaret Millard in Region 5, and so you want to have cumulative environmental issues. Just because of the level of funding, you probably do not want to have an air monitor in your application. However, we do work with the WDNR, and we leverage technical assistance as needed. So as you're going through your CARE Level 1 process, if this was identified as an issue, then we can work with them to see what could be leveraged in with our own Office of Research and Development. And, in fact, that was done in our Milwaukee CARE project. But in terms of your application, your focus for Level 1 should be on gathering and analyzing information on cumulative environmental issues, air, water, waste, everything.
Okay. All right, thank you.
We started out the CARE program these many years ago really feeling that there was a lot of information out there, and that rather than collecting new information, we would like to see CARE communities make better use of the existing information that's there. So in general, we felt this wasn't about collecting new data. It was about, though, using the existing data in new and better ways and finding partners that are very useful for getting more information, analyzing information, and the like. That's where that idea of your partnership becomes very important.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. The next phone line question, again, #6. Go ahead and state your name and organization and ask your question. Okay, so I don't hear anything coming in online. I'll switch back to the streaming simulcast questions that have come in. We do have a number of those, and you can continue typing those up. We'll go back to the phone lines in just a few minutes. But until then, let's start with Prescott Creek coming in from Prescott, Arizona. And they say, a review of past grant recipients indicated that there is an emphasis on environmental justice. The RFP this year does not obviously support this. Is this a change, or is there an emphasis on environmental justice?
First of all, CARE was never an environmental justice program. It was a program to assist all communities. We do have a number of our grant recipients who are working in environmental justice areas. In fact, we've averaged out to about 90% of them, of our awardees, are environmental justice area. We haven't changed anything like that. If you look on your, in Section 5 of your RFP under the evaluation criteria, the first evaluation criteria for the Level 1 and for the Level 2 talks about the extent of environment and public health problems. And the second bullet says, impacted by multiple stresses on economically disadvantaged communities and or vulnerable communities and populations. That gets to environmental justice. So we have an element, a criteria element, right in our, where it's supposed to be. You have, you can get a maximum of 8 points for that. So that gives you a little bit of extra push there.
But you don't have to be an EJA community and be awarded a CARE grant.
That's right. And we have a number of communities who are not working in EJA areas.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Two Creeks Property Owners Association in Frankfort, Kentucky. And they just wanted to let you know they thought it was a great presentation, that they're very interested in the program, and they're going to do some additional research. But just off the bat, they want to know if a property owners association would be eligible for funding, or would they have to partner with their local water company or local government to be eligible?
They just have have to be a nonprofit. If they're a nonprofit, they're eligible for funding. Let me see what page that's on. We have eligible applicants listed. And it lists everyone who can apply, and they really just have to be a nonprofit. If that association is a nonprofit, they can apply.
There, in fact, are at least a couple questions in the question and answer document, and references you to, there's an OMB document that gives you the operational definition of who and what is a nonprofit. So you may want to also take a look at that.
And so it's on page 18. Thank you, Patrice, for finding it for me. It's on page 18, and it talks about who's eligible. And it says local public nonprofit institution organizations, federal recognized Indian tribal government, Native American organizations, private nonprofit institution organizations, quasi-public nonprofit institution organizations, local government colleges and universities are eligible for CARE grants. So as long as you're a nonprofit, you can apply. You do not, I would suggest that you partner with those other people, with the local government and the water board. But you can apply.
Okay, great. Thanks. The next question is coming in from Maricopa County Asthma Coalition in Phoenix, Arizona. And they ask, what if the broad community has already identified and expressed concern around one local environmental health issue? Can a Level 1 proposal set up partnerships that explore, define, and strategize around this issue while allowing identification of additional community environmental health issues through the community education process?
No. I mean, I just have to go back to what we've been saying. It's maybe CARE is not for you. CARE, it has to be, has to look at a broad array of issues. You cannot, so maybe you're not really a CARE Level 1. Maybe you're a little bit higher than that, and we don't have anything to fund you. And so maybe you should look elsewhere and then come back as a partner to someone. Wait until we get our budget, our appropriations language, and then maybe you can apply for a Level 2 if you articulate it, that you've done that.
We feel very strongly about this cross-media, multimedia approach. So just keep that in mind. I mean, that's really a core value of CARE, and I guess we've got now three or four questions about people who sort of asked. The answer is going to be the same.
And the reason for this is from the very beginning, people have told us that, it's not just, they're just not a one-issue community. Their community has multiple issues. cumulative risks, you know, and from different viewpoints are saying different things, and that's why we try to have a broad partnership. So, if you can't be multimedia, then CARE is probably not for you.
Okay, thanks. I'll take another question that's coming online, and then we'll switch back over to the phone lines. This question is coming in from Monroe County Government in Bloomington, Indiana, and it is a two-part question. And the first question asks, for the Level 1 grant, is it expected to have a list of environmental concerns, or should we describe the process to determine those?
You should articulate the process of how you're going to look and find those environmental concerns or any other concerns. They could be social economic concerns. So Level 1 is not just restricted to environmental concerns, but it's the process you're describing to us, how you're going to find them, and also the process of how you're going to reach consensus around them and how you're going to prioritize them on the ones you're going to address first as a Level 2.
Okay. And the second part of her question, if we already have a partial and possibly complete list, should we include that in our proposal?
Well, as long as you can articulate to us that you have done this type of broad-based gathering of information and that you've included it more than the people from Monroe County government, but you've included a partnership. As long as you articulate to us that you've done that, because we're going to look for that. We're going to look and make sure that you've done the process. Then you can include it. And I would suggest that you include it as this is what we found so far, not that it's definite and complete.
Okay. We're going to switch back over to the phone lines, and this is a reminder, if you're on the phones and you have a question, go ahead and hit #6, then identify yourself and organization and ask your question. Okay. Don't hear anybody popping on the line, so we'll continue on with the online questions. You can continue to submit those and type them up, and we'll get to those. We do have at least another hour left in the session. So let's go ahead and start with a question that came in from Waste Management in Palmdale, California. And they ask, in a Level 1 grant, would funding for identifying problems and solutions cover the purchase of equipment to help better identify the level of the problem in order to better identify options to remediate the issue?
CARE is not about buying equipment in general. There is no prohibition against that, but CARE Level 1 grant is only $100,000, and we're expecting actually quite a bit. So this is not a way of buying lots of stuff. This is about focusing on the community, focusing on the people, focusing on the people's perceptions of the problems confronting them, and really that's where you ought to put your effort, not going out and, as we said before, collecting more data, analyzing more data. We think there's a lot of data out there, and find partners who can help you better analyze the existing data.
And just so you know, and it states it in the RFP as well, when it does, if you're fortunate enough to make the cut to come to the National Selection Committee, we look at, one of the elements we look at is a direct benefit to the community. And if we don't see a direct benefit to the community for buying some equipment, then your competitiveness to get the grant goes down.
Okay. The next question comes in from the Shelby County Health Department for Pollution Control, Memphis, Tennessee. And they ask, is the CARE cooperative agreement made to the local or state government agency, or can the award be made to the community partner?
The award can be made to the local government agency, not the state agency. We do award to local governments as well as tribal governments. So it can be awarded to the local government agency. But you have to articulate that you have a partnership, and it's full, broad partnership, and that partnership is driving this project. It cannot be driven by the county health department.
And we'll be more emphatic. The state government cannot receive a CARE grant. We very much hope that they will be a partner, as many partners that you're putting together for your project, but the grants will not be awarded to state government.
Okay. The next question is coming in from an organization identified as PAG in Tucson, Arizona, and they say that this is another clarifying question about awarding Level 2 cooperative agreements. They say that their community was awarded a Level 2 cooperative agreement in 2006. Does that mean that they're eligible to apply for either a Level 1 or Level 2 cooperative agreement now?
No. It's in the RFP. You cannot, once you have a Level 2 grant, you're not eligible to apply for another CARE grant.
And remember, part of Level 2 is about becoming self-sustaining. That's an important factor. So we are hoping that successful Level 2 grantees are still continuing to do their work, and they've found other ways than EPA to and the CARE program to support that.
And so that's found in the RFP on page 9. It's page 9. It's at the top of the page, and it's number 10. It says two levels of CARE funding. So what I just said is found there.
And there's another factor here. On page 36 of the RFP, we talk about geographic balance as we try to award CARE grants. And you see the map, and we have CARE grants all across the United States. While the same community or same general area is not excluded, the simple fact that we want to have a lot of CARE communities spread across the United States really runs against having two CARE grants in essentially the same community.
Okay, great. I'm going to take another question that's been submitted online, and this one's coming in from Watershed LLC in Durango, Colorado, and they're asking to clarify some of the earlier questions on Level 1 versus Level 2 funding. And the clarifying question is, so long as one of the participants successfully received a Level 1 grant, and as long as that participant is involved in the 2011 grant, a Level 2 could be pursued. Is that correct?
As long as one of the participants... that is correct. That is correct, but they have to be a partner. So if they're a partner of the original Level 1 partnership, then that is correct, that they can, because we actually have two Level 2s that have done that already, and they have to show us. One of them was in northern New Mexico, and they had, just so you can understand the example, they had a Level 1, and it was a county government that had the Level 1, and they worked on three different projects. And one of those particular projects, the partners that were in one of the areas became the Level 2. So it has to be that connection. We have to see that connection. That you can't just tell us that connection. That connection has to be in that final report of the Level 1. So it has to be articulated so we can follow that timeline and pathway from that Level 1 partnership to the Level 2.
And Marva?
Uh-huh.
This is Michelle. I'm not sure if it was just the wording of that question, but it seemed to leave a space also for we're also wanting it to address the same community, right?
The community, yes, Michelle,
yes.
Thank you. The community that was articulated in the Level 1, yes. So it's an ongoing sustainability project. That's what CARE is about, sustainability, building healthy communities. So it has to be continuing on with that same Level 1 community. Thank you, Michelle.
Okay, great. We'll do another one online, and then we'll double-check to see if there are any phone questions. So this last one online, and we'll keep bouncing back and forth, don't worry. But the question online is coming in from the Upper Tennessee River Roundtable in Abingdon, Virginia. And they state that we're in a rural area of Virginia and are trying to decide between a project in a small TMDL watershed versus a larger project over our entire watershed. Is preference given to the geographical size of the community, or is a smaller focused area project acceptable?
We believe that it should be a local community partnership. And so how do you define that? We want to make sure that your partners live, work, and play in the community. And we want to make sure that you can work very closely with your partners. So when you say preference given to the geographical size of the community, we don't really have a preference for that, except that we don't want it too large. But if you have a smaller, more focused area proposal, that's going to get a lot more attention from the selection panel, because we feel that smaller, more focused community partnership will really be there for the long run to build sustainability in that healthy community and build a healthy community.
Okay, let's switch over and see if we have any questions coming in on the phone lines. Again, if you're on the phone, simply hit #6, state your name and organization, and ask your question.
Hi, this is Deborah Weiss from the Commission for Greater Tomorrow again.
Oh, hi, Deb. We may have a problem here with interference on the line. Let's see.
Hold on. Okay.
Okay, it seems like the ringing stopped.
Okay. I can ask another question, right?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay, so if we, you know, obviously you want a multimedia approach, and the, you know, whole process is to come up with solutions for the problems that you see, in the original, because we're applying for a level one, in the original proposal then, should we include any possible solutions that we see at this time, or should we just kind of outline problems? I mean, because I know you want more of a, you said you kind of want a broad focus on all the different areas that tie in together. Do you want that kind of specialization, like, you know, what we see as solving air problems, what we see as solving water problems? Do you want that, or you just want, you know, the problems, I guess?
Well, first of all, you only have 10 pages, right? So you got to be careful with your space, right? And, you got to answer the evaluation criteria, right? And so you got to be careful about all that. We've seen in the past, I'll just share what we've seen in the past. They're called low-hanging fruit, I guess, is that we're thinking where people are articulating a process of that they're going to look at broad, this broad-based approach. But they also may say, you know, in their history of their community work or whatever, that they have been working in these issues, and these are things that we have been working in, we know is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't take away from your articulating a process, because that's what we want. But if you put it in your RFP, I mean, in your proposal, that you've been working with a certain issue, and this is the outcome of it, or this is also something you want to enfold into your process, that's okay, because it'll be in the work plan. You know, mm-hmm. So you don't want to lose that, because you've been, because we know communities were not born today. They weren't born March 22nd, you know, when the proposals are due. So you have this history that you want to, you know, envelop into your articulated process. So that's okay. You can do that. But make sure that you still look at it from a multimedia approach. And make sure that you keep to your 10 pages. And make sure that you answer the evaluation criteria. Because you don't want anything to throw you out. You know, while you're telling us about this problem, you know, you've got. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
And that's a good watchword for everyone. As you think of questions, or should I do this or that, really take a quick look at the evaluation criteria. That's what you should be judged on. And we put it in there in page 29 to 31 because we want you to know how you're going to be judged. So put together your proposal, those criteria in mind.
But just to be fair to you, we do look at the wealth of history of a community that's been doing this work for a while. You know, that's important too. I mean, that's part of your background, right?
Yeah.
And it shows us how you are already connected to that community. And that's important for us to see.
Okay, thanks. If there's another phone line question, again, take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, and then go ahead and state your name and organization and ask the question.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Benny Hayden, and I'm a sustainability consultant based in Detroit, Michigan. I like to say that I'm new to this process, and I need a clarification on the point you made earlier about the appropriation impact on the level of funding. And if I'm new to the process and I'm looking to create a partnership, so I will be applying for a level one at this point. Are you saying that because of the appropriation process, the funding for a level ones would be at a later date than a level two? Is that correct? Am I interpreting that correctly, or?
No, you're not.
Okay, well, please clarify.
Okay, okay. This is a grant program for care level ones and level twos. So care level ones are eligible with the funding we have available right now. What gets you the grant is how well you write the proposal and how well you compete with the other proposals. What we're saying is that for anyone who's applying for a care level two this year, they have already have had to complete a care level one. That's all we're saying.
Okay.
You've got you're applying for a care level one, you're fine, but you've got a lot of competition out there, and you have to make sure that you articulate the process in a clear and concise way of everything that's required in a level one.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, let's see if we have another phone line question or comment. Again, #6, identify yourself and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Sean Flaherty with Triangle J, Council of Governments in the Research Triangle Park region of North Carolina. I had a question relative to the scalability of the community that was kind of touched on earlier. In the greater Research Triangle Park region, we really consider ourselves as living, working, and playing in the small town, Chapel Hill, City of Durham, and City of Raleigh, especially because of our university system. Would you consider that a scalable community, or is that still too large of a region for this effort?
We haven't defined the scale of the community so much as saying that, your community may be too large if it's the entire city of New York City or the entire city of Chicago. So we haven't defined whether a small town, which is Raleigh and Durham, is a scalable city. We haven't defined that. If you can articulate it in a way that shows us that you're going to have a local partnership involvement, then we're not going to turn you away for that.
Thank you.
It'll come down to how well you can put together your proposal and show that you are really going to form these coalitions, gather these folks up to have really an intense look at what are the issues. Actually, I'm pretty familiar with the RTP area, and that's a pretty big area, both in terms of landmass and in terms of three different communities. So it's your call, but you may be better served by looking at one of the three at a truly local scale level.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's see if we have another phone line question. Again, take
Hello, my name meeting. Is Catherine Esparza with the City of Austin Brownfields Program.
Okay.
And we've been approached by a nonprofit sustainability program or entity here in Austin, Texas. They've partnered with us in addressing brownfields properties to convert them to affordable housing projects. They're interested in pursuing a grant that just so happens to encompass some of these brownfields that have already received US EPA assessment grants and other properties in the area for cleanup funds. Can they apply for this grant and cite these projects as some ongoing partnerships or discuss these projects as examples as part of the community outreach and education, or they can't apply since they have several projects that they're working on in the target area?
Well, first of all, we ask you to tell us what other federal grants you have. And so we want you to tell us about them. But second of all, you've got to articulate it in a way that you're looking at that broad-based arena and not just brownfields.
Okay.
You have to. I mean, or you won't get the award. For example, the City of Austin can apply. He doesn't have to be the sustainable development person. And you also have to tell us that the kind of partnership you're having, and how it's broad-based. And how you're looking across your arena. So, you can apply, but if you apply and all you're talking about is brownfields, we're going to throw you out as being a singular media.
Right, and that's why we were not going to apply for it in the nonprofit that has a wide array to include project experience and partnerships with the community. They were pursuing it, and we were going to partner with them to assist where we can, but they're the ones pursuing it.
Oh, okay. Well, you may want to also look at page 17 of the RFP.
That's what I'm looking at, the third bullet.
Yeah, when it says that that you've got to be careful with things like brownfields and Superfund, because if you write a proposal, because I help with the eligibility review, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you write a proposal and it's very heavy on what we're doing on a brownfield site or what we're doing on a Superfund site, we're going to think that you want to continue on with the work being done on that site, and legally we can't award for any additional work on the brownfields or Superfund because they're doing the work.
Right.
They're doing the work in brownfields or Superfund. So you have to be very careful how you write the proposal.
Okay.
The proposal has to be, it can encompass what you're doing on brownfields, but it can't be heavily on brownfields. It has to talk about the broader based piece. In fact, I would suggest you not even include the brownfields piece.
Going to recommend to the nonprofit, but the nonprofit is eligible to apply for this grant, yes?
Oh, yes.
Yes, a nonprofit
okay.
is eligible to apply. They have to articulate it in a way that we know it's multimedia.
Right.
You know, I'm sure you've done grant reviews from the city, so you know when they come in, you know, there's this eligibility review. And if people see it and they're talking about brownfields or Superfund or whatever that we're not allowed to award, they're going to throw them out.
Sure. I understand. Thank you.
It's not just Superfund. There's a couple others that are listed there on page 17 as well. You know, for example, the diesel school bus retrofit program, that's a whole separate program. If you want money for that, you go to that program, not to CARE.
And the purpose for that, this is for everyone on the call, is because CARE was set up as a demonstration project, so to demonstrate that we can make a difference in these communities. But at the same time, our lawyers told us we could not grant awards to someone the work was being done elsewhere in the agency. Like the work was being done in the brownfields office or the Superfund office or the air office. So you got to be very careful. That's why I say sometimes CARE is not for everybody, because we're looking at it from a different perspective, a unique perspective that EPA has not looked at before, and that's the multimedia cumulative risk perspective.
Okay. Let's switch back over to the online questions that have been submitted, because we still have a number of those to go through. So I'm going to start with a question that came in from Allegheny's County Health Department in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and they ask, is it expected that all Level 1 awardees will eventually apply for and receive Level 2 grants? Would it be considered a success if the community chooses to resolve identified issues without a Level 2 grant?
Most definitely.
Sure.
Most definitely. In fact, we encourage it. I mean, we only have so much funding, and we have a lot of partners. We have partners with HUD and housing urban development. We have partners with Centers for Disease Control. We have partners with Health and Human Services, Department of Energy. And so we expose all of our grant awardees to these partnerships that we have, and we encourage them. And a lot of our grantees have gotten additional funding from these different federal agencies. So we encourage that. We encourage them to broaden themselves, become bigger than EPA. That's really kind of the purpose of why we say you identify all the risks in your community, because all the risks are not risks addressed by EPA.
What percentage
of
level 1 receive level 2?
A number of them.
Because
I
don't know if it's expected that they will receive a level 2.
Well,
oh.
People on the phone
yeah.
will...
You
okay.
have to apply
right,
for
right,
level
right.
2.
I got it. Okay.
These are separate processes, and you, after completing your level 1, decide if you want to compete for level 2, and it is the same competitive process.
Yeah.
Somewhat different evaluation criteria, mm-hmm. but the same process.
It's the same competitive process, and we only have so much funding, and they're a lot more expensive. And so, you know, we have a number that have received a level two, but like we've only been in existence for 5 years, so we're not, we can't really say how many yet. But it's a growing number.
All right, let's take the next question that comes in from Berkshire Regional Planning Commission in Pittsfield. And this one is a specific one about a project. They say, we know that PCBs is our contaminative concern, and they identify the responsible party that has proposed an expansive cleanup of PCB-contaminated river that flows through three towns. There's no public consensus on whether to accept the cleanup project, and we're desperately in need of a region-wide public outreach program to explain the cleanup options being proposed, the short and long-term implications of the cleanup on these communities. So is conducting an expansive public information outreach program appropriate and competitive for this type of grant?
No. It's a one issue, right? I mean, we said that you cannot have the one issue. This is not a expansive public information outreach program. This is a program that wants to build a healthy community. And so part of that is to build a partnership, identify all your risks, prioritize your risk, reach consensus, articulate how you're going to reduce your risk. You cannot do it on a one issue. Sorry, I'm blunt, but that's the best way to tell you.
There's been a question that's come in related to that, that for the people who have projects or concerns that don't fall into the global aspects of care, what would you suggest that they do? Who should they contact? Would it be state organization and a local branch? Are there other grants that the EPA offers that might be available to them?
Yeah, well, we do. I would suggest, in the slideshow, I had a grants guide that we had that's on the CARE webpage, www.epa.gov/care. And I would suggest they look through that. And that has multiple agency grant opportunities in it that may help them. We actually, on our CARE webpage, as a service to anyone who's interested in CARE, when we hear about some grants that are available, we put it on our front page as a link. We had recently we had USDA Agricultural 3 grants up there. Right now we're getting ready to put the Environmental Justice Small Grants link up there because that's out on the street. So we try to link to different pages from our webpage to help people as well.
Okay, great. The next question I'm going to take is coming in from Columbus, Ohio, from the USGS, and they ask, are personnel from other federal agencies eligible to receive Level 1 funds as part of a community partnership?
So that would be paying their salary?
No.
It doesn't have a clarification, and perhaps if the woman from USGS who asked this question could provide additional information, that'd be helpful.
No, the answer is no. We're not gonna look favorably.
Well, there's also appropriation law that really trumps this about one agency paying for another personnel.
Yeah, I mean, I would suggest that when they retire, they can work as a consultant to that community. I mean, we're not gonna let that go through.
But what it does bring up is the importance of partnerships. That would be a great partnership for your project. And I think in most cases, you can forge partnerships with federal agencies without paying them.
Right. We encourage that, and we have, we are talking to federal agencies all the time, and they like the CARE program, and they want to partner with people on the CARE program. So it is a great partnership, and it helps us link into that agency to see what's available for you as a grant awardee to maybe help build your sustainability with another agency's funding. They could be an unpaid technical assistant person, people who are giving technical assistance to that community. But is Keisha on the phone? I know Keisha. You're not saying anything, but I'm sure that wouldn't go. I'm sure that wouldn't go. *6, Keisha, if you have anything to add. She's our grant.
That's okay. We'll have a question that's somewhat related to that that came in online from Migrant Health Promotion in Saline, Michigan. And they ask, throughout the RFP, it mentions community-based partnerships and collaborative stakeholder groups. What is the difference between the two?
I think we consider them interchangeable. We consider them interchangeable. Some folks call it collaborative stakeholder groups. Some folks call it partnerships. We consider it interchangeable. It's groups that get together and become a partnership, or it's individuals that get together and become a partnership. So, like a stakeholder group, you know, if you're a resident, where do you fit? You fit as a partner, as part of the partnership, more so as part of the stakeholder group, because you're not with any group of people. So we consider them interchangeable.
Okay. Let's go back onto the phone lines and see if we have any questions from our phone line participants. If you're on the phone, go ahead and hit #6, identify yourself and organization, and ask the question. Okay, I'm going to go back then to the online questions. We still have those. You guys can keep typing them up. And we will switch back to the phone lines in a few minutes. So if you, something does pop in your head, hang tight. We'll come back to you. I've had a couple of different questions that have come in from people looking for examples. And this is from a variety of organizations across the country. They'd like to hear about acceptable examples of uses of funds for both Level 1 and Level 2 agreements.
Well, I would suggest that they go on the CARE website. We have a number of final reports up there from our 2005 and 2006 grants, and there's a link there that they can access it and read, and that talks about what they did in their projects. So that might be a great way to do that for them. They're very easy to do.
That's a wonderful resource. If you're wondering, we have information about every one of the CARE communities that we've awarded grants to. So take a look at that. Those are people who successfully put together proposals.
And we also have on our website and our documents publications page, we have something called the Promising Practices. And we've highlighted 14 CARE communities on that document. And that shows what they've done to end their CARE project and how it's been transferable to other issues and agency-wide issues and interagency issues. And so it shows what the CARE program has done for these particular communities, and it just gives you a good sense of what kind of work they're doing. And that's called the Promising Practices Guide.
Okay. Well, the next question that I'll take is coming in about dates, and this is coming in from Marketing for Green, LLC, again, coming in from Canton, Michigan. And they're asking, please clarify, what is the date that CARE Level 2 will be awarded? And then what is the date that CARE Level 1 will be awarded? And in parentheses, is this dependent on the 2011 budget process?
We are the proposals are due March 22nd. They're for both CARE Level 1 and CARE Level 2. We are operating on fiscal year 10 budget because the 11 budget hasn't been signed. So that means we have up to $2.1 million to award. And so that's a combination of CARE Level 1 and CARE Level 2. The date of award, selection will probably be in sometime in late May, and you will know sometime during the summer before September 30th if you have been chosen for award.
And we try to notify people along the way. We notify people if they were deemed ineligible very quick.
Yeah.
And so it's a tiered process. The process is, in fact, explained, I believe it starts on page 36 of the RFP, of how we go forward and how we do this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, eligibility review is first, and we have to notify you within 15 days. It's a requirement. And we do that by letter, and the letter comes from me. Then we if you are eligible, your proposals are partialed out to the particular region in your area. And this is all in the RFP, as Dennis said. But it's, you know, I'll refresh your memory. And it's partialed out to the regions. And then they have a regional review. And their review pretty much takes place sometime through the month of April. And if you're selected as to come to the National Selection Committee, if you're a top scorer in the region, then you come to the National Selection Panel Committee. And we meet usually near the end of May, and then we make our selections. But along the way, you are notified at every step of the way.
Okay, great. There are some specific questions about some of the text in the proposal. I'm going to take this question that's coming in from Massachusetts Opportunity Council in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. And they ask, in the proposal under sending, it mentions that CARE funding cannot be used for surveys of more than 9 people by the recipient, which is on page 9. Can you please clarify? And there's another question related to that, and they want to know, you know, does this include the use of focus groups or community outreach meetings or only formal one-on-one surveys?
This is very clear. There is an OMB requirement on this. If you look at the Q&A document, in fact, it has all the citations there. OMB says that if you survey more than 9 people, it is required for them to approve that. In fact, this approval process is very long and protracted, so that we recommend you not do it. Otherwise, at the end of 2 years, you may not have got approval. This really points out the importance of partners. You have partners who can do all of those things you mentioned, and as long as they're not using CARE grant funds, they can do it. So, again, it's the power of who you put together as your partner allows you to really craft a very creative plan, a very creative approach to addressing these issues.
So we are talking about a formal survey, a written survey. Focus groups is different.
Right.
That's a discussion, so you can have your focus groups. That doesn't come into play here. Also, in the Q&A document, and so I just found where this was in the Q&A document, is question 5 on page 19 when you get the document up so you can read for yourself. Also, I want to tell you about the Q&A document. It's a very important document. Please read it, because what's in the Q&A document is a lot of questions we've had over the last 5 years. And so we revamped them, we've massaged them, make sure that you won't have to ask the same question again. And so it's there for you to look at what some of your counterparts have asked early on, and we've gotten their answers to them. So it will help you write your proposal. So it's almost as important as the RFP. RFP is the Bible. You got to follow it legally. But the Q&A document gives you a little added incentive to figuring out what the RFP says.
And it's organized so that you can hopefully find things fairly quickly and easily. And as we do get new questions, and that does happen, we will add them to the Q&A document and note that at the top, changes since the last version of the document. And questions will just be put in the appropriate section at the end of that. They'll just increment.
Okay. The next question is coming in from the city of Edinburgh in Edinburgh, Texas. And they ask, when talking statistics, our demographic numbers are from the 2000 census. We would like to use the projected numbers for 2010, since the 2010 census is not yet available. They want to know if that's okay.
Yes. Well, yeah, it's fine with us.
You use the best data that you think is available that can help you make your case.
Yeah. We're not a research paper. I think at a research paper you have to be more, you know, this is more, we say it's community-driven, community-based. This is more what you think is best for your community, how you're going to look at your pollutants across your community. We want you to tell us what your community looks like. I mean, you might even tell us a story about your community. That's fine, too. You don't have to be so research-oriented in your proposal writing.
Okay. The next question comes in from the New Jersey Tree Foundation from Newark, New Jersey, and they ask, what qualifies as a toxic risk?
What qualifies?
Yeah, I think that's in the Q&A document.
Yeah, I'm looking for it now.
And Margo looks. Frankly, you've chosen not to have a specific definition. We've purposely been a little bit vague on this so that toxic can be issues like climate change. Toxic can be other things. A toxic, though, could not be something like AIDS in your community. That's an example of something. It's a serious problem, no doubt, in many communities, but that not would not fall under our definition of toxic. Again, I refer you to look at what other people have done and see how other people have chosen to define toxics in their community, and I think you'll see that it's been pretty broad, though it's largely intuitive. It's things that we can look at and feel like, well, yeah, that makes sense.
And Catrice is going to read you something out of the Q&A document, and I just want to let you know that we have a whole chapter on care definitions, and so that's why it's important to look at the Q&A document. So she's going to read you that question and answer on that definition.
It's actually question F1 on page 21 of the Q&A document when you get a chance to review it. And it basically says, how do you define risk as mentioned in the care request for initial proposals? And the answer to that is, risk is the possibility of a person suffering harm to their health or to the quality of their environment. Risk comes from the exposure of the person or their environment to a toxic substance or pollutant or to the combination several threats. In some cases, a substance may be harmful not because it is intrinsically hazardous, but because the amount may be so large as to disrupt the natural, ecological, and biological system. So that's the definition of risk.
And further down in that page, it talks about what the term toxic pollutants and environmental concerns, and it refers to local environmental risk and their related health impacts. And we say the focus is a broad range of toxic substances and environmental pollutants can be in the air, water, and our land, or in the indoor environment. The environment concerns can be due to direct or indirect effects on human health or environmental equality. We are not limiting the term. Okay?
Okay.
That's broad.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines and see if we have any vocal questions. If you're on the phone, if you'd like to ask a question, please hit #6, identify yourself, and then make your statement or question.
Barza, the City of Austin.
Okay.
My question is from a legality perspective and the devaluation of an individual's property. Have any communities experienced the identification of property owners or responsible parties that do not have the resources to address the risks that the community may have identified? And is there any problems from a legal perspective with communities identifying without environmental site assessment, scientific activity have been occurred before they apply for a grant? Does that make sense?
I don't think we've come across that yet. But in our community partnerships, I've seen projects that have worked with the city government's housing authority to make sure that they're on board and addressing all the concerns that are arisen. We don't find that in the application process. We find that more in the implementation of doing the work. The application process, we don't find a problem with that because what they're doing is that they're articulating a process. So they're not, you know, so that can be worked out more carefully with their partners to make sure that they're not legal issues, I think. Is that true? That you think?
Yeah, we're both sort of looking at each other here. One of the things is care is not a lot of money. And so to have as part of your project fixing people's houses or doing some kinds of remediation is not part of the care process, nor is it economically feasible with the amount of money you get. So
usually they're working with another agency to to do some type of repair, like with HUD or something.
Exactly. We do have, and I'm going to send you to the CARE community list. Look at Pueblo, Colorado. And the Pueblo, Colorado CARE grant focused on radon in homes. Mm-hmm. And I guess because I know that one a little better than most, they have lots of associated things that they did as part of the CARE process, and they saw the power that they had by virtue of joining together, and all sorts of things start happening above and beyond the CARE grant itself.
And so I would say that our grants more helps build that community capacity to start looking at situations that they could help reduce. And so they're not at the level of where it could be a legality problem. I mean, that level may come later as they become more sustainable, but they're at the definitional type level right now.
Did that get to your question?
Yeah, I think so, yes. Thank you.
Okay. If someone else on the phone line has a question, go ahead. #6, identify yourself and ask the question. Okay, and then we'll switch back to the online questions. And we're going to go to the next question that's coming in from the Western Hard Rock Watershed Team in Durango, Colorado. And they state that their organization works to build capacity with the rural community and watershed groups across Colorado and New Mexico. And they'd like to know if they would be less competitive because they partner with many communities instead of focusing on one specific community.
Well, first of all, you're across two states. So you would be ineligible by that because you're too large. We're not going to do a multi-state award. We're not doing a project that focuses on a multi-state award.
Or either
a statewide award. I mean, you could have a section of New Mexico. We've had that before. Like a couple of counties together or something like that. But you would be ineligible.
CARE is more than just a watershed project. Again, and we'll say it over and over, I suppose, CARE is meant to be a multimedia, cross-media program. So focusing on one media to the exclusion of the others is not a successful proposal.
And so just so you know, we have some successful CARE projects awards mm-hmm. that are along a watershed, but they're looking at more than just the watershed, and that's why they became CARE grantees.
Okay, my next question comes in from Taunton River Watershed Alliance, again in Taunton, Massachusetts. And they ask, what if the community already has a number of groups formed around different problems, such as air and asthma, water pollution and sewer treatment plants, etc.? Do we need to engage them all as partners at the application level, or should that be part of the implementation of the grant?
I'm assuming they're talking about a CARE Level 1. So maybe that's a big assumption. So if they're talking about CARE Level 1, they have to let us know. They have to let us know their plan for involving these people. They don't have to be in the partnership rate on March 22nd, but they have to articulate a plan and how they're going to be involved.
And it sounds like you have a good start. I would suggest take a look at the Western Michigan project that, in fact, took a number of existing quite successful groups and really meld them together into a larger project, because actually I know the local asthma coalition was folded into the larger coalition for Grand Rapids.
Okay. The next question comes in from the Estill County Health Department in Irvine, Kentucky. And you guys probably have already addressed this, but just to be sure, if you are awarded a Level 1 CARE funding, can you expand on that Level 1 and submit for Level 2 when your budget is set?
You're awarded for a Level 1, period. If you want to do a Level 2, you have to complete the Level 1 process and then apply for a Level 2.
There's a proposal.
Okay. This next comment is coming in from the School District of Palm Beach County in West Palm Beach, Florida. And they state, or they ask, is the purpose of this to gather and analyze data to help devise a future project? It sounds like they're hearing that development of a quote-unquote project is not the objective.
Okay, so the purpose of a level one is to form a partnership, community-based partnership that includes business and local government and residents, and is to articulate a process on of identifying all the risks on a place-based area. So that's a level one. It's to figure out what's going on in that community and how, and as you figure it out, how you're going to reach consensus among those issues and how you're going to prioritize those issues. That's your project. You know, it's the beginning of a implementation project. So that's your project. And level two is to take those prioritization lists and decide which of those priorities you're going to work with as you articulate a process for a level two. So I think maybe it's semantics what you're calling a project. But to us, that's your project. Building that broad-based partnership, articulating that process of identifying your risks, prioritizing those risks, reaching consensus of it. That's your project.
Okay. There was a question someone asked where they can find the Q&A document that you've been referencing, and this is just a reminder. It's available as an additional resource from the Links to Resources page on the seminar homepage. When we're all done today, that's going to be one of the final links that I'll point everyone to. So you'll be able to download the RFP, take a look at the CARE website, and also download the Q&A document that they've been referencing. So I just wanted to remind people that we will point you to that before we close out today. This is a longer question, but I'm going to read it out loud. It's coming in from Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi. And they state, we have an open mind to look for an array of potential toxins in our targeted community. And we have a fabulous potential to build a broad stakeholding community of partners to explore those potential toxins and work together to develop a plan for them. But our targeted community is very poor, and we don't have a lot of data already on hand about the toxins that are there. Because of the poverty and the age of the housing stock, we know that we have widespread indoor environmental toxins, and we have a railroad that runs through the community, which has no doubt dropped its share of toxins over the decades. We definitely have multiple toxins and lots of interest in working with others to find and analyze data and develop community-embraced solutions, but we don't think we have a big, quote, sexy environmental challenge. Just the kind of ordinary multiple stresses that exist in many low-income communities. Without something, quote-unquote, sexy, should we even bother applying?
Well, we're not looking for anything sexy in a level one. We're not. We're looking for just what they're saying. We're looking for someone to tell us about all the different pollutants and how they're going to address them and how they're going to build a partnership. It's a very competitive program, and if you... We also... Because it's so competitive in this respect for this Jackson, Mississippi person, they may want to look at what they're doing and on what the Environmental Justice Program is doing as well, because their proposals are out right now. They're a little bit less money. I think they're $50,000, and that may get them started on that, on their issues a little bit better than CARE. Jean, can we jump over to Keisha Holliday? She was one of my experts. She got discontinued and she didn't hear the question we were asking her. And I just want to restate the question. That question, Tina, was about another federal agency wanted to get paid on a CARE grant, working on a CARE grant. And we told them that you couldn't do that. And I said, where's Keisha? Keisha, I'm sure you have an answer for that. And that we wouldn't even look at something like that. They would not, the budget would not be eligible for us.
Right. You said they actually wanted to get paid for working on the grant?
Yes, ma'am.
No, that's not allowable.
Yeah, we
figured that.
We said that. It's nice to reaffirm what you said. And again, we'll just remind people, having a federal agency as part of your CARE partnership would allow you to request work of them without the expectation they would be paid for it. Your tax dollars pay for other agencies as well. So include these other agencies as your partners and don't expect that you have to somehow get money over to them.
Yeah, and we actually, just so you know, when you're awarded a CARE grant and a regional team is formed around you, we also look for an interagency partner in that regional team. Like if you, if you're working in the case of Pueblo, Colorado that, that Dennis mentioned, if you're looking a lot, working a lot with radon and indoor air, you know, we may want to have the Healthy Homes Division of the HUD agency, you know, to be a partner as well. And they, we bring them in to talk to you, and we make those connections for you. So we work very closely with our other federal agencies, but we don't pay them.
No.
Thanks, Keisha.
And I'm just going to ask a clarifying, because it wasn't sure to me when I read the question if they meant that they were a federal employee, but they were a member of the community that was potentially applying for a grant. So if they happened to be a federal employee, but as a community member, they would be part of the grant application. Would that be permissible?
Well, what would they be paying them for? We don't just pay people as part of the CARE program. We don't get $10 for showing up at a meeting. I mean, and there's a whole series of procedures about subcontracting and the like. So all of those really come into play.
We would definitely have to run it by legal, you know, about what kind of advice they're giving them. Is their advice related to the work they do at their agency? Because that's an ethical question. So
it sounds like they probably need to, like, ask more questions so that we can get to the heart of what they're actually trying to get from us. I would suggest that they could give me a call directly, and I can kind of work through that with them. But it sounds like initially what they're proposing is definitely a conflict of interest, and we definitely wouldn't pay another organization.
Another federal organization.
Yeah.
Right.
Just in violation of appropriation law.
Exactly.
And there's a whole lot of ethics involved there, too.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Keisha.
Okay. I've got just a few more questions that have been submitted online, and then we'll switch back over to make sure there aren't any closing phone comments and questions. If you are streaming audio and you do have a question that's been lingering, please try to type it up quickly so we can address it before we close out at 3 p.m. today. In the meantime, though, I'm going to start with a question that came in from Monroe County Government in Bloomington, and they ask, for clarification on past performance and programmatic capability, are you asking for examples similar to the RFP, i.e., you know, $90,000, or the overall project assuming award, for example, $250,000?
No, what we wanted to do there is just tell you an example of what we normally see. That's what we normally see for level one. That's what we normally see for level two. But we also see $300,000 for level twos, and we also see $100,000 for level ones. So you have to articulate it, you have to make sure your work plan is, and your budget coincides, and that you have a budget that of $90,000 that fits in with the work you're trying to do, you're articulating you're going to do. So we look at that very closely in selection, at the selection panel. Does your budget match up with the work? And so what we were giving on the slideshow was just an example of what we've seen in the past. But officially, legally, you can get up to $100,000 for a level one and up to $300,000 for a level two.
And if you ask for more than those caps, you will, in fact, become ineligible.
That's right.
So make sure. There's always a couple folks that ask for more money than which is always a shame. It's time and effort.
Yeah, it was real sad. I real case. It was like they asked for $306,000, but it was $6 over the 300 mark, and I had to make them ineligible. Real case, and they had a good proposal. So be very careful, and before you submit, to make sure you adhere to all the rules.
Okay, let's take the next question that comes in. And we have two more online, which I think you've addressed, but we're just going to go through them because they're here. The next one comes in from the City of Edinburgh in Texas, and this is more clarification about equipment. And they ask, can we include funding for equipment in a Level 1 proposal?
He's chuckling here. I mean, yes, you can. And, in fact, you have a budget. That equipment would need to be reflected in the budget. In general, as we said before, the CARE project is not about buying a lot of equipment. That's not our focus. Our focus is community building. And if this equipment helps you do that, well, sure, that would make sense. But, you know, we see people proposing to buy a garbage truck or proposing to do these things, that just won't work. So really be thoughtful about it. Make sure that you include it in your budget and understand that and look at the CARE goals again and the strategies. It's really not an equipment dense.
It's not an equipment purchasing grant program. It's a community-based partnership, identifying your risks type of program. And if you're fortunate enough to get to a selection panel and you have a large dollar value for equipment in there, we're going to question it. We're going to make sure that it's a direct benefit to the community. We're going to make sure there's not an unevenness of it, that it's more equipment than working and done in the community. So just be very logical and truthful.
Okay. And the last question that I have, I think this is, again, more of a clarifying question from one that was asked earlier, is coming in from Waste Management in Palmdale, California. And they ask, if a community has one major environmental problem, however, all stakeholders have not recognized the level of concern that it causes for their particular responsibilities, would a CARE Level 1 grant help to identify the overall concern and bring it to the appropriate stakeholders?
So would it help identifying the overall concerns of the community? Yes. Will we take your word that it only has one major environmental problem? No. We're looking at a multimedia cross environmental concerned program. I'm not saying that concern is not a major concern. I'm just saying that you have to articulate for us that you've looked at all the various concerns in that community, and you have to do it in the proposal.
Okay. I'll go back over to the phone lines as I don't have any more comments or questions that have come in online. And this is just a reminder, if you're on the phones and you have a final comment or question, please take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, identify yourself and organization, and then ask your question. Going on.
You hear me? This is Deborah Weiss.
Yep.
From the Commission on Green and Rural. Okay. I got another question for y'all.
Go ahead.
In terms of budgeting for costs, if you have one person that is going to be expected to really run the program on behalf of the rest of the organization, can you write down a salary in the budget page? How does that work? I don't know.
Yeah, you can. We have a sample budget in our piece.
Page 49.
We know that, as Dennis is saying, page 49, it's in Appendix C. And we understand that, especially for small organizations, that you may have to include some personnel costs. We understand that, but we also, we don't look favorably if all the whole grant goes to personnel costs.
Because
we're not there to fund the person for you, but we know that if it's a small organization, you may need to hire somebody to run the project.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
And so we know you might have to do that.
Okay.
So we look at a good balance there, and that's why we gave you a sample budget narrative for you.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, so thank you.
Uh-huh.
Okay, any other comments or questions from the phones?
Sure, I have a question. This is Allison from Eugene, Oregon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I wanted to find out, this is an administrative question, I wanted to find out if it's possible to apply to both a grant for the CARE program as well as for the EJ small grants program, or to confirm, are we only allowed to apply to one grant?
You can apply to many programs as you want. The problem comes in that you can't do the same work for both programs. So,
right.
For example, if you apply for the same work, project work for both programs, and what if you get it, right? You're going to be in trouble because EPA can't award the same work for both programs. So
mm-hmm.
I would suggest that if you're going to apply for both programs, they're for different projects or different. There's a different take on the project.
Right. Okay. Sounds good. Thanks.
Keisha, did you want to add anything to that, or is that okay, what I said?
Keisha, if you're on mute, it's #6 to take yourself off of mute.
Okay, well, it's okay.
Okay.
I know that's okay.
Okay. Well, I'll make one last call for a final question or comment from the phone lines.
And again, I can't, Jean, I just can't impress enough the RP, that's the Bible, but also when the Q&A, the question and answers get up there, document, read that, because a lot of these questions have already been answered in the question and answer document. It's about 30-some pages, but late-night reading before you put your proposal in to make sure that you've crossed all your T's and are not going to be thrown out for something silly, right?
And I want to just take a moment, since I guess we have a moment, to remind people there are two ways you can submit your proposal. It's through express delivery service, that is FedEx, UPS, et cetera. The address is in the RFP. You can also submit it via grants.gov, which is an electronic process. If you do it via grants.gov, you need to have an ID prior to that. It sometimes takes a while to get that ID. So if you are planning to use grants.gov, make sure you get your ID as soon as possible.
And all that stuff is in the RFP, but I think we can't impress it upon you enough, because we've had people call us at the 11th hour because they could not get something through grants.gov, and it's too late to send it by express mail.
Yeah, and we have no control over grants.gov. It is a government-wide system, and I will tell you that we can't even very successfully answer questions if you have problems or the like. You're going to have to go through grants.gov. It's a little bit like filing your income tax electronically.
Well, it's been a pleasure answering your questions. I think I speak for all of us. And again, in the RFP, it tells you if you have a question, a follow-up question, who to email it to. And it was the voice you just heard, Dennis O'Connor. His email is o'connor.dennis@epa.gov. Also, I want to remind you that we have a couple of more webcasts. One's on the 23rd and one's on March 2nd. But they'll be very similar to this one, so you do not have to get on. However, in the RFP, we do have a link where you can go to a link to download the versions of the conversations so you can hear them in your home, you know, without getting on the call. And I guess, Jean, we're going to put up the question and answer document very shortly.
Yep. It's already up, actually.
Thank you.
If you're done with your closing statements and comments, just want to make sure you don't have anything else you'd like to close with.
Well, we just want them to fill out the seminar feedback form, because that helps us make an improvement in our webcast every year.
Okay. Well, then with that, I'm going to direct everyone to move on to the final slide of today's presentation, which is slide 18. And as you've heard referenced numerous times throughout today's session, there are a few resources that are available on what we've linked as the additional resources page. On slide 18, you can click on the additional resources link, and that'll bring you to a listing of resources, including today's PowerPoint presentation, a copy of the RFP to download, a link to the CARE website, as well as a copy of the Q&A document that they've been quoting from throughout today's presentation. So if you haven't seen that already and you'd like to read it, go ahead and go to the additional resources page. If you have a print copy of the materials today and you don't actually have the electronic version of it, you can certainly refer back to the confirmation email from me. If you look at the seminar homepage, there will be links on either the left side or the bottom, which will bring you to the additional resources page where you can access these materials. The other link that you'll see highlighted on the final slide on 18 is our feedback form. And as Marva mentioned, we do ask that you take just a minute or two to complete the feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you're sharing the computer with multiple participants, when you submit feedback, as soon as you fill out that form, there will be a link that you can click on that will allow another participant to fill out the form. So each person can submit their own feedback. If you're looking for credit or verification of your participation today, when you submit feedback, there's a small box you can check, and you'll see an image of that on slide 18. that you can actually have a confirmation message emailed to you for your records. So for those of you who are concerned about CEUs or PDHs, while we don't issue them here through CUIN, sometimes the organizations that you're trying to get credits from or applying to use your CEUs will accept a copy of the materials as well as confirmation messages such as that to verify that you did participate. Remember, as we said, the entire session was recorded, and as soon as the archive is up, which usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, you'll get an automatic email from me letting you know how you can access the recordings. You can either download them, you can replay them online, you can even get to them in iTunes. We have a podcast for free if you search for the Cleanup Information Network. You'll find us there. So with that, that's the end of the official training today. Again, if you missed it or you want to refer a colleague to the live session, as Barbara mentioned, there will be two additional deliveries in the coming months. You can certainly visit cluin.org/training to look for those seminars and sign up for them. I want to thank our organizers here at EPA as well as all of the participants and presenters who joined us on today's call. I appreciate everyone finding time to fit this into your busy schedule, and I hope that it was a useful expenditure of your time today. If you have any other questions or comments, you can certainly reach out to me. This is Jean Mallon in EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. And with that, that will be the formal conclusion of today's seminar. Thank you all so very much for joining us. I hope you have a great rest of the day.